with him that night, for Jesus taught him the mystery of the kingdom of God. And thence, arising, he returned to the other side of the Jordan. This episode appears in no existing version of the Gospel of Mark. In its general outlines, however, it is familiar. It is, of course, the raising of Lazarus, described in the fourth Gospel, ascribed to John. In the version quoted, there are some significant variations. In the first place, there is a great cry from the tomb before Jesus rolls the rock aside, or instructs the occupant to come forth. This suggests that the occupant was not dead, and thereby, at a single stroke, contravenes any element of the miraculous. In the second place, the passage quoted attests to some special relation between the man in the tomb and the man who resurrects him. A modern reader might be tempted to see a hint of homosexuality. It is possible that the Carpocratians, a sect who aspired to transcendence of the sense by means of satiation of the senses, discerned precisely such a hint. But as Professor Smith argues, it is in fact much more likely that the whole episode refers to a typical mystery school initiation, a ritualized and symbolic death and rebirth of the sort so prevalent in the Middle East at the time. In any case, the point is that the episode and the passage quoted do not appear in any modern or accepted version of Mark. If Mark's gospel was so drastically expurgated, it was also burdened with spurious additions. In its original version, it ends with the crucifixion, the burial, and the empty tomb. There is no resurrection scene, no reunion with the disciples. The Gospel of Mark thus provides two instances of a sacred document, supposedly inspired by God, which has been tampered with, censored, revised by human hands. It is reasonable to assume that the other Gospels were similarly treated. For the purposes of our investigation, we could not accept the Gospels as unimpugnable, but at the same time, we could not discard them. They were certainly not wholly fabricated, and they furnished some of the few clues available to what really happened in the Holy Land 2,000 years ago. We therefore undertook to look more closely, to separate the truth they contained from the spurious matrix in which that truth was often embedded. And in order to do this effectively, we were first obliged to familiarize ourselves with the historical reality and circumstances of the Holy Land at the advent of the Christian era. For the Gospels are historical documents like any other. They are products of a very specific place, a very specific time, a very specific people, and very specific historical factors. More than half a century before Jesus' birth, Palestine fell to the armies of Pompey, and Roman rule was imposed. But Rome at the time was too preoccupied with her own affairs to install the administrative apparatus necessary for direct rule. She therefore created a line of puppet kings to rule under her aegis. This line was that of the Herodians, who were not Jewish, but Arab. One must visualize a conquered land and a conquered people ruled by a puppet regime which was kept in power by military force. The people of the country were allowed to retain their own religion and customs, but the final authority was Rome. In AD 6, the country was split administratively into one province, Judea and Samaria, and two tetrarchies, Perea and Galilee. Herod Antipas became ruler of the latter, but Judea, the capital, was rendered subject to direct Roman rule, administered by a Roman prefect based at Caesarea. The Roman regime was brutal and autocratic. 3,000 rebels were summarily crucified. The temple was plundered and defiled. Heavy taxation was imposed, torture was frequently employed, and many of the populace committed suicide. This state of affairs was not improved by Pontius Pilate, who presided as prefect of Judea from AD 26 to 36. In contrast to the biblical portraits of him, existing records indicate that Pilate was a cruel and corrupt man who not only perpetuated but intensified the abuses of his predecessor. The Jews in the Holy Land at the time could be loosely divided into several sects and subsects. There were, for example, the Sadducees, a small but wealthy landowning class who collaborated with the Romans. There were the Pharisees, a progressive group who introduced much reform into Judaism and who, despite the portrait of them in the Gospels, placed themselves in staunch, albeit largely passive, opposition to Rome. There were the Essenes, an austere, mystically oriented sect whose teachings were much more prevalent and influential than is generally acknowledged or supposed. Among the smaller sects and subsects, there were many whose precise character has long been lost to history, and which therefore are difficult to define. It is worth citing the Nazareans or Nazarenes, a term which seems to have been applied to Jesus and his followers. Indeed, the original Greek version of the New Testament refers to Jesus as Jesus of Nazarene, which is mistranslated in English as Jesus of Nazareth. Nazarene is a specifically sectarian word and has no connection with Nazareth. There were numerous other groups and sects as well, one of which proved a particular relevance to our inquiry. In AD 6, when Rome assumed direct control of Judea, a Pharisee rabbi known as Judas of Galilee had created a highly militant revolutionary group known as Zealots. By the time of Jesus' mission, the Zealots had assumed an increasingly prominent role in the Holy Land's affairs. Long after the crucifixion, Zealot activity continued. By AD 44, this activity had so intensified that some sort of armed struggle seemed inevitable. In AD 66, the struggle erupted, the whole of Judea rising in organized revolt against Rome. It was a desperate, tenacious, but ultimately futile conflict. At Caesarea alone, 20,000 Jews were massacred by the Romans. Within 4 years, Roman legions had occupied Jerusalem, razed the city, and sacked and plundered the temple. The aftermath of the revolt in Judea witnessed a massive exodus of Jews from the Holy Land. Nevertheless, enough remained to foment another rebellion some 60 years later, in AD 132. At last, in 135, the Emperor Hadrian decreed that all Jews be expelled by law from Judea, and Jerusalem became essentially a Roman city. Jesus' lifetime spanned roughly the first 35 years of a turmoil extending over 140 years. The turmoil did not cease with his death, but continued for another century, and it engendered the psychological and cultural adjuncts inevitably attending any such sustained defiance of an oppressor. One of these adjuncts was the hope and longing for a Messiah who would deliver his people from the tyrant's yoke. It was only by virtue of historical and semantic accident that this term came to be applied exclusively to Jesus. For Jesus' contemporaries, no Messiah would have ever been regarded as divine. Indeed, the very idea of a divine Messiah would have been preposterous. The Greek word for Messiah is Christ or Christos. The term, whether in Hebrew or Greek, meant simply the anointed one, and generally referred to a king. Thus David, when he was anointed king in the Old Testament, became a Messiah or a Christ, and every subsequent Jewish king of the house of David was known by the same appellation. Even during the Roman occupation of Judea, the Roman-appointed high priest was known as the Priest Messiah or Priest Christ. For the Zealots, however, and for other opponents of Rome, this puppet priest was a false Messiah. For them, the true Messiah implied something very different: the legitimate Roi Perdu, or Lost King, the unknown descendant of the house of David who would deliver his people from Roman tyranny. During Jesus' lifetime, anticipation of the coming of such a Messiah attained a pitch verging on mass hysteria, and this anticipation continued after Jesus' death. Indeed, the revolt of AD 66 was prompted in large part by zealot agitation and propaganda on behalf of a Messiah whose advent was said to be imminent. The term Messiah implied nothing divine. It was a term with specifically political connotations. It was this mundane political term that was applied to Jesus. He was called Jesus the Messiah, or translated into Greek, Jesus the Christ. Only later was this designation contracted to Jesus Christ, and a purely fictional title distorted into a proper name. The Gospels issued from a recognizable and concrete historical reality. It was a reality of oppression, of civic and social discontent, of political unrest, of incessant persecution and intermittent rebellion. There was also a reality suffused with perpetual and tantalizing promises, hopes and dreams that a rightful king would appear, a spiritual and secular leader who would deliver his people into freedom. Modern scholars are unanimous in concurring that the Gospels do not date from Jesus' lifetime. For the most part, they date from the period between the two major revolts in Judea, 66 to 74 and 132 to 135, although they are almost certainly based on earlier accounts. These earlier accounts may have included written documents since lost, but there would certainly have been oral traditions as well. Some of these were undoubtedly received at second, third, or fourth hand. Others may have derived from individuals who were alive in Jesus' lifetime and may even have known him personally. A young man at the time of the crucifixion might well have been alive when the Gospels were composed. The earliest of the Gospels is generally considered to be Mark's, composed sometime during the revolt of 66 to 74, or shortly thereafter. Although not himself one of Jesus' original disciples, Mark seems to have come from Jerusalem. He seems to have been a companion of St. Paul, and his gospel bears an unmistakable stamp of Pauline thought. But if Mark was a native of Jerusalem, his gospel was composed in Rome, and addressed to a Greco-Roman audience. At the time that Mark's gospel was composed, Judea was, or had recently been, in open revolt, and thousands of Jews were being crucified for rebellion against the Roman regime. If Mark wished his gospel to survive and impress itself on a Roman audience, he could not possibly present Jesus as anti-Roman. Indeed, he could not feasibly present Jesus as politically oriented at all. He would have been obliged to exonerate the Romans of all guilt for Jesus' death and blame the death on certain Jews. This device was adopted not only by the authors of other Gospels, but by the early Christian Church as well. Without such a device, neither Gospels nor Church would have survived. The Gospel of Luke is dated by scholars at around AD 80. Luke himself appears to have been a Greek doctor who composed his work for a high-ranking Roman official at Caesarea, the Roman capital of Palestine. For Luke too, therefore, it would have been necessary to placate and appease the Romans and transfer the blame elsewhere. By the time the Gospel of Matthew was composed, approximately AD 85, such a transference seems to have been accepted as an established fact and gone unquestioned. More than half of Matthew's Gospel, in fact, is derived directly from Mark's. The author seems to have been a Jew, quite possibly a refugee from Palestine. He is not to be confused with the disciple named Matthew, who would have lived much earlier and would probably have known only Aramaic. The Gospels of Mark, Luke, and Matthew are known collectively as the Synoptic Gospels, implying that they see eye to eye or with one eye, which, of course, they do not. Nevertheless, there is enough overlap between them to suggest that they derived from a single common source. This distinguishes them from the Gospel of John, which portrays significantly different origins. Nothing whatever is known about the author of the fourth gospel. Indeed, there is no reason to assume his name was John. Except for John the Baptist, the name John is mentioned at no point in the gospel itself, and its attribution to a man called John is generally accepted as later tradition. The fourth gospel is the latest of those in the New Testament, composed around AD 100 in the vicinity of the Greek city of Ephesus. It displays a number of quite distinctive features. There is no nativity scene, for example, no description whatever of Jesus' birth, and the opening is almost Gnostic in character. The text is of a decidedly more mystical nature than the other Gospels, and the content differs as well. The other Gospels, for instance, concentrate primarily on Jesus' activities in the northern province of Galilee, and reflect what appears to be only a second or third-hand knowledge of events to the south, including the crucifixion. The fourth gospel, in contrast, says relatively little about Galilee. It dwells exhaustively on the events in Judea and Jerusalem, which concluded Jesus' career, and its account of the crucifixion may well rest on some first-hand eyewitness testimony. It also contains a number of episodes and incidents which don't figure in the other gospels at all. On the basis of such factors, modern scholars have suggested that the Gospel of John, despite its late composition, may well be the most reliable and historically accurate of the four. More than the other Gospels, it seems to draw upon traditions current among contemporaries of Jesus, as well as other material unavailable to Mark, Luke, and Matthew. One modern researcher points out that it reflects an apparently first-hand topographical knowledge of Jerusalem prior to the revolt of AD 66. The same author concludes, "Behind the fourth gospel lies an ancient tradition independent of the other gospels." This is not an isolated opinion. In fact, it is the most prevalent in modern biblical scholarship. On the basis of our own research, we too concluded that the fourth gospel was the most reliable of the books in the New Testament, even though it, like the others, had been subjected to doctoring, editing, expurgation, and revision. It was in the fourth gospel that we found the most persuasive evidence of our, as yet, tentative hypothesis. It was not our intention to discredit the Gospels. We sought only to locate certain fragments of possible or probable truth. Fragments that might attest to a marriage between Jesus and the woman known as the Magdalene. Such attestations, needless to say, would not be explicit. In order to find them, we realized we would be obliged to read between the lines. We would also have to look for evidence of circumstances that might have been conducive to a marriage. Our inquiry would thus have to encompass a number of distinct but closely related questions. We began with the most obvious of them. Is there any evidence in the Gospels, direct or indirect, to suggest that Jesus was indeed married? There is, of course, no explicit statement to the effect that he was. On the other hand, there is no explicit statement to the effect that he was not. And this is both more curious and more significant than it might first appear. The Gospels state that many of the disciples were married, and at no point does Jesus himself advocate celibacy. On the contrary, in Matthew chapter 19, verses 4 through 5, he declares, "Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh." Such a statement can hardly be reconciled with an injunction to celibacy. And if Jesus did not preach celibacy, there's no reason either to suppose that he practiced it. According to Judaic custom at the time, it was not only usual but almost mandatory that a man be married. Except among certain Essenes in certain communities, celibacy was vigorously condemned. During the late first century, one Jewish writer even compared deliberate celibacy with murder. And he does not seem to have been alone in this attitude. And it was as obligatory for a Jewish father to find a wife for his son as it was to ensure that his son be circumcised. If Jesus were not married, this fact would have been glaringly conspicuous. It would have drawn attention to itself and been used to characterize and identify him. It would have set him apart in some significant sense from his contemporaries. If this were the case, surely one at least of the Gospel accounts would make some mention of so marked a deviation from custom. If Jesus were indeed as celibate as later tradition claims, it is extraordinary that there is no reference to any such celibacy. The absence of such reference strongly suggests that Jesus was married. This alone would satisfactorily explain the silence of the Gospels on the matter. The argument is summarized by a respected contemporary theological scholar. It is highly probable that Jesus was not married well before the beginning of his public ministry. If he had insisted upon celibacy, it would have created a stir, a reaction which would have left some trace. So the lack of mention of Jesus' marriage in the Gospels is a strong argument not against but for the hypothesis of marriage, because any practice or advocacy of voluntary celibacy would, in the Jewish context of the time, have been so unusual as to have attracted much attention and comment. The hypothesis of marriage becomes all the more tenable by virtue of the title Rabbi, which is frequently applied to Jesus in the Gospels. It is possible, of course, that this term is employed in its very broadest sense, meaning simply a self-appointed teacher. But Jesus' literacy strongly suggests that he underwent some species of formal rabbinical training. This would conform to tradition, which depicts Jesus as a rabbi in the strict sense of the word. But if Jesus was a rabbi in the strict sense of the word, a marriage would not only have been likely, but virtually certain. The Jewish Mishnaic law is quite explicit on the subject. An unmarried man may not be a teacher. If Jesus was married, Is there any indication in the Gospels of the identity of his wife? On first consideration, there would appear to be two possible candidates, two women who are mentioned repeatedly in the Gospels as being of his entourage. The first of these is the Magdalene, or more precisely, Mary from the village of Magdal, or Magdala, in Galilee. In all four Gospels, this woman's role is singularly ambiguous. In the accounts of Mark and Matthew, she's not mentioned by name until quite late. When she does appear, it is in Judea at the time of the crucifixion, and she is numbered among Jesus' followers. In the Gospel of Luke, however, she appears relatively early in Jesus' ministry, while he is still preaching from Galilee. It would thus seem that she accompanies him from Galilee to Judea, or, if not, that she at least moves between the two provinces as readily as he does. This in itself strongly suggests that she was married to someone. In the Palestine of Jesus' time, it would have been unthinkable for an unmarried woman to travel unaccompanied. Popular tradition notwithstanding, the Magdalene is not at any point in any of the Gospels said to be a prostitute. When she is first mentioned in the Gospel of Luke, she is described as a woman out of whom went seven devils. It is generally assumed that the phrase refers to a species of exorcism on Jesus' part, implying that the Magdalene was possessed. But the phrase may equally refer to some sort of conversion and/or ritual initiation. The cult of Ishtar, or Astarte, the mother goddess and queen of heaven, involved, for example, a seven-stage initiation. Prior to her affiliation with Jesus, the Magdalene may have been associated with such a cult. Before he speaks of the Magdalene, Luke alludes to a woman who anointed Jesus. In the Gospel of Mark, there is a similar anointment by an unnamed woman. Luke reports that she was a fallen woman, a sinner. Subsequent commentators have assumed that the Magdalene, since she apparently had seven devils cast out of her, must have been a sinner. On this basis, the woman who anoints Jesus and the Magdalene came to be regarded as the same person. In fact, they may well have been. If the Magdalene were associated with a pagan cult, that would certainly have rendered her a sinner in the eyes not only of Luke, but of later writers as well. If the Magdalene was a sinner, she was also, quite clearly, something more than the common prostitute of popular tradition. Quite clearly, she was a woman of means. Luke reports, for example, that her friends included the wife of a high dignitary at Herod's court, and that both women, together with various others, supported Jesus and his disciples with their financial resources. The woman who anointed Jesus was also a woman of means. In Mark's Gospel, great stress is laid upon the costliness of the spikenard ointment with which the ritual was performed. The whole episode of Jesus' anointing would seem to be an affair of considerable consequence. Why else would it be emphasized by the Gospels to the extent it is? One must remember that anointing was the traditional prerogative of kings, and of the rightful Messiah, which means the Anointed One. From this it follows that Jesus becomes an authentic Messiah by virtue of his anointing, and the woman who consecrates him in that august role can hardly be unimportant. It is clear that the Magdalene, by the end of Jesus' ministry, has become a figure of immense significance. In the three synoptic Gospels, her name consistently heads the lists of women who followed Jesus, just as Simon Peter heads the list of male disciples. And of course, she was the first witness to the empty tomb following the crucifixion. Among all his devotees, it was to the Magdalene that Jesus first chose to reveal his resurrection. Throughout the Gospels, Jesus treats the Magdalene in a unique and preferential manner. Such treatment may well have induced jealousy in other disciples. The portrayal of her as a harlot may well have been the overcompensation of a vindictive following, intent on impugning the reputation of a woman whose association with Jesus was closer than their own, and thus inspired an all too human envy. Whatever the status of the Magdalene in the Gospels, she is not the only possible candidate for Jesus' wife. There is one other who figures most prominently in the fourth Gospel, and who may be identified as Mary of Bethany, sister of Martha and Lazarus. She and her family are clearly on very familiar terms with Jesus. They are also wealthy, maintaining a house in a fashionable suburb of Jerusalem, large enough to accommodate Jesus and his entire entourage. What is more, the Lazarus episode reveals that this house contains a private tomb, not only a sign of wealth, but also a status symbol attesting to aristocratic connections. When, in the fourth gospel, Lazarus falls ill, Jesus is staying with his disciples on the Jordan. Hearing of what has happened, he delays for 2 days and then returns to Bethany, where Lazarus lies in the tomb. As he approaches, Martha rushes forth to meet him and cries, "Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." John chapter 11, verse 21. It is a perplexing assertion, for why should Jesus' physical presence necessarily have prevented the man's death? But the incident is significant because Martha, when she greets Jesus, is alone. One would expect Mary, her sister, to be with her. Mary, however, is sitting in the house and does not emerge until Jesus explicitly commands her to do so. The point becomes clearer in the secret Gospel of Mark, discovered by Professor Morton Smith and cited earlier. In the suppressed account, Mary does emerge from the house before Jesus instructs her to do so, and she is promptly and angrily rebuked by the disciples, whom Jesus is obliged to silence. It would be plausible enough for Mary to be sitting in the house when Jesus arrives in Bethany. In accordance with Jewish custom, she would be sitting shiva, sitting in mourning. But why does she not join Martha and rush to meet Jesus on his return? There is one obvious explanation. By the tenets of Judaic law at the time, a woman sitting shiva would have been strictly forbidden to emerge from the house except at the express bidding of her husband. There is substantial reason for regarding the Magdalene and the woman who anoints Jesus as one and the same person. Could this person, we wondered, also be one and the same with Mary of Bethany, sister of Lazarus and Martha? Could these women, who in the Gospels appear in 3 different contexts, in fact be a single person? The medieval church certainly regarded them as such, and so did popular tradition. Many biblical scholars today concur. There is abundant evidence to support such a conclusion. If Jesus was indeed married, there would thus seem to be only one candidate for his wife, one woman who recurs repeatedly in the Gospels, under different names and in different roles. If the Magdalene and Mary of Bethany are the same woman, and if this woman was Jesus' wife, Lazarus would have been Jesus' brother-in-law. Is there any evidence in the Gospels to suggest that Lazarus did indeed enjoy such a status? Lazarus does not figure by name in the Gospels of Luke, Matthew, and Mark, although his resurrection from the dead was originally contained in Mark's account and then excised. As a result, Lazarus is known to posterity only through the fourth Gospel, the Gospel of John. But here it is clear that he does enjoy some species of preferential treatment, which is not confined to being raised from the dead. In this and a number of other respects, he would appear, if anything, to be closer to Jesus than the disciples themselves. Unlike the disciples, Lazarus is actually menaced. According to the fourth gospel, the chief priests, on resolving to dispatch Jesus, decided to kill Lazarus as well. John chapter 12, verse 10. Lazarus would seem to have been active in some way on Jesus' behalf, which is more than can be said of some of the disciples. In theory, this should have qualified him to be a disciple himself, and yet he is still not cited as such. Nor is he said to have been present at the crucifixion, an apparently shameless display of ingratitude in a man who quite literally owed Jesus his life. Granted, he might have gone into hiding, but it is extremely curious that there is no further reference to him in the Gospels. He's never mentioned again. Or is he? We attempted to examine the matter more closely. After staying in Bethany for 3 months, Jesus retires with his disciples to the banks of the Jordan, not much more than a day's distance away. Here, a messenger hastens to him with the news that Lazarus is ill. But the messenger does not refer to Lazarus by name. On the contrary, he portrays the sick man as someone of very special importance. "Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick." John chapter 11, verse 3. Jesus' reaction to this news is distinctly odd. He blithely dismisses the matter. When Jesus heard that, he said, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby." Chapter 11, verse 4. And if his words are perplexing, his actions are even more so. When he heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Chapter 11, verse 6. At last he resolves to return to Bethany. He's still unperturbed, however. He states plainly, "Our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep." Chapter 11, verse 11. And 4 verses later, he virtually admits that the whole affair has been carefully staged, managed, and arranged in advance. "And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent ye may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him." Chapter 11, verse 15. If such behavior is bewildering, the reaction of the disciples is no less so. "Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, Let us also go, that we may die with him." Chapter 11, verse 16. What does this mean? If Lazarus is literally dead, surely the disciples have no intention of joining him by a collective suicide. And how is one to account for Jesus' own carelessness, the blasé indifference with which he hears of Lazarus' illness and his delay in returning to Bethany? The explanations of the matter would seem to lie, as Professor Morton Smith suggests, in a more or less standard mystery school initiation. As Professor Smith demonstrates, such initiations and their accompanying rituals were common enough in the Palestine of Jesus' era. They often entailed a symbolic death and rebirth, sequestration in a tomb, a symbolic immersion in water, and a cup of wine which was identified with the blood of the prophet or magician presiding over the ceremony. By drinking from such a cup, the disciple consummated a symbolic union with his teacher, the former becoming mystically one with the latter. It would seem, then, that Lazarus, during Jesus' sojourn at the Jordan, has embarked on a typical initiation rite. In this light, the disciples' desire to die with him becomes perfectly comprehensible, as does Jesus' complacency about the whole affair. Granted, Mary and Martha would appear to be genuinely distraught, as would a number of other people, but they may simply have misunderstood the exercise. If the Lazarus incident does reflect a ritual initiation, he is clearly receiving very preferential treatment. He is apparently being initiated before any of the disciples. But why should this hitherto unknown man of Bethany be singled out? And why should the entire episode have been expurgated from the Gospel of Mark? Perhaps because Lazarus was he whom Jesus loved more than the other disciples. Perhaps because Lazarus had some special connection with Jesus, like that of a brother-in-law. Perhaps both. It is possible that Jesus came to know and love Lazarus precisely because Lazarus was his brother-in-law. The author of the Gospel of John, the Gospel in which the Lazarus story figures, does not at any point identify himself as John. In fact, he does not name himself at all. He does, however, refer to himself by a most distinctive appellation. He constantly calls himself the beloved disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and clearly implies that he enjoys a unique and preferred status over his comrades. Who is this beloved disciple on whose testimony the fourth gospel is based? All evidence suggests that he is in fact Lazarus, he whom Jesus loved. This conclusion would seem to be almost inevitable, nor were we alone in reaching it, according to Professor William Brownlee, a leading biblical scholar. From internal evidence in the fourth gospel, the conclusion is that the beloved disciple is Lazarus of Bethany. If Lazarus and the beloved disciple are one and the same, it would explain Lazarus's mysterious disappearance from the scriptural account and his apparent absence during the crucifixion. For if Lazarus and the beloved disciple were one and the same, Lazarus would have been present at the crucifixion, and it would have been to Lazarus that Jesus entrusted the care of his mother. The words with which he did so might well be the words of a man referring to his brother-in-law. "When Jesus therefore saw his mother, and the disciple standing by, whom he loved, he said unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour that disciple took her unto his own home." John, Chapter 19, verses 26 and 27. The last word of this quotation is particularly revelatory. For the other disciples have left their homes in Galilee and to all intents and purposes are homeless. Lazarus, however, does have a home, that crucial house in Bethany where Jesus himself was accustomed to stay. If Jesus had a wife and children, they presumably would have been entrusted to the beloved disciple as well. This, of course, would be all the more plausible if the beloved disciple were indeed his brother-in-law. According to much later tradition, Jesus' mother eventually died in exile at Ephesus, from whence the fourth gospel is said to have subsequently issued. There is no indication, however, that the beloved disciple attended Jesus' mother for the duration of her life. According to Dr. Schoenfield, the fourth gospel was probably not composed at Ephesus, only reworked, revised, and edited by a Greek elder there, who made it conform to his own ideas. If the beloved disciple did not go to Ephesus, what became of him? If he and Lazarus were one and the same, that question can be answered, for tradition is quite explicit about what became of Lazarus. According to tradition, Lazarus, the Magdalene, Martha, Joseph of Arimathea, and a few others, were transported by ship to Marseille. Here, Joseph was supposedly consecrated by St. Philip and sent on to England, where he established a church at Glastonbury. Lazarus and the Magdalene, however, are said to have remained in Gaul. Tradition maintains that the Magdalene died at either Aix-en-Provence or Saint-Baume, and Lazarus at Marseille after founding the first bishopric there. If Lazarus and the beloved disciple were one and the same, there would thus be an explanation for their joint disappearance. Lazarus, the true beloved disciple, would seem to have been set ashore at Marseille together with his sister, who, as tradition subsequently maintains, was carrying with her the Holy Grail, the blood royal. If Jesus was indeed married to the Magdalene, might such a marriage have served some specific purpose? In other words, might it have been something more than a conventional marriage? Might it have been a dynastic alliance of some kind, with political implications and repercussions? Might a bloodline resulting from such a marriage have fully warranted the appellation blood royal? The Gospel of Matthew states explicitly that Jesus was of royal blood, a genuine king, a lineal descendant of Solomon and David. If this is true, he would have enjoyed a legitimate claim to the throne of a united Palestine, and perhaps even the legitimate claim. And thus, he would have engendered the opposition he did precisely by virtue of his role, the role of a priest-king who might possibly unify his country and the Jewish people, thereby posing a serious threat to both Herod and Rome. To suggest that Jesus enjoyed such a claim is, of course, to challenge the popular image of the poor carpenter from Nazareth. But there are persuasive reasons for doing so. In the first place, it's not altogether certain that Jesus was from Nazareth. Jesus of Nazareth is, in fact, a corruption or mistranslation of Jesus the Nazarite or Jesus the Nazarene. There is considerable doubt as to whether the town of Nazareth actually existed in Jesus' time. It does not occur in any Roman maps, documents, or records. It is not mentioned in the Talmud. It is not mentioned, still less associated with Jesus, in any of the writings of St. Paul, which were, after all, composed before the Gospels. And Flavius Josephus, the foremost chronicler of the period, who commanded troops in Galilee and listed the province's towns, makes no mention of Nazareth either. It would seem that Nazareth did not appear as a town until some time after the revolt of AD 68 to 74, and that Jesus' name became associated with it by virtue of the semantic confusion which characterizes so much of the New Testament. Whether Jesus was of Nazareth or not, there is no indication that he was ever a poor carpenter. Certainly none of the Gospels portray him as such. Indeed, their evidence suggests quite the contrary. He seems to be well-educated. He seems to have undergone training for the rabbinate and to have consorted as frequently with wealthy and influential people as with the poor. Joseph of Arimathea, for instance, and Nicodemus. And the wedding at Cana would seem to bear further witness to Jesus' status and social position. This wedding does not appear to have been a modest, humble festival conducted by the common people. On the contrary, it bears all the marks of an extravagant aristocratic union, attended by at least several hundred guests. Jesus' presence at it, and his mother's, would suggest that they were members of the same caste. If Jesus was an aristocrat, and if he was married to the Magdalene, it is probable that she was of comparable social station. We've seen she numbered among her friends the wife of an important official at Herod's court, but she may have been more important still. As we had discovered by tracing references in the Priore documents, Jerusalem, the holy city and capital of Judea, had originally been the property of the tribe of Benjamin. Subsequently, the Benjamites were decimated in their war with the other tribes of Israel, and many of them went into exile. Although, as the Priore documents maintain, certain of them remained. One descendant of this remnant was St. Paul, who states explicitly that he is a Benjamite. Romans chapter 11, verse 1. Despite their conflict with the other tribes of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin appears to have enjoyed some special status. Among other things, it provided Israel with her first king, Saul, and with her first royal house. But Saul was eventually deposed by David of the tribe of Judah. And David not only deprived the Benjamites of their claim to the throne, by establishing his capital at Jerusalem, he deprived them of their rightful inheritance as well. According to all New Testament accounts, Jesus was of the line of David, and thus also a member of the tribe of Judah. In Benjamite eyes, this might have rendered him, at least in some sense, a usurper. Any such objection might have been surmounted, however, if he were married to a Benjamite woman. In the New Testament, there is no indication of the Magdalene's tribal affiliation. In subsequent legends, however, she is said to have been of royal lineage, and there are other traditions which state specifically that she was of the tribe of Benjamin. At this point, the outlines of a coherent historical scenario begin to be discernible. Jesus would have been a priest-king of the line of David who possessed a legitimate claim to the throne. He would have consolidated his position by a symbolically important dynastic marriage. He would then have been poised to unify his country, mobilize the populace behind him, drive out the oppressors, and restore the glory of the monarchy as it was under Solomon. Such a man would indeed have been King of the Jews. As Gandhi's accomplishments bear witness, a spiritual leader given sufficient popular support can pose a threat to an existing regime. But a married man, with a rightful claim to the throne and children through whom to establish a dynasty, is a threat of a decidedly more serious nature. Is there any evidence in the Gospels that Jesus was in fact regarded by the Romans as such a threat? During his interview with Pilate, Jesus is repeatedly called King of the Jews. In accordance with Pilate's instructions, an inscription of this title is also affixed to the cross. As Professor S.G.F. Brandon of Manchester University argues, the inscription affixed to the cross must be regarded as genuine, as much so as anything in the New Testament. In the first place, it figures with virtually no variation in all four Gospels. In the second place, it is too compromising, too embarrassing an episode for subsequent editors to have invented it. In the Gospel of Mark, Pilate, after interrogating Jesus, asks the assembled dignitaries, "What will ye then that I shall do unto him, whom ye call the King of the Jews?" Mark chapter 15, verse 12. This would seem to indicate that at least some Jews do actually refer to Jesus as their king. At the same time, however, in all four Gospels, Pilate also accords Jesus that title. There is no reason to suppose that he does so ironically or derisively. In the fourth Gospel, he insists on it quite adamantly and seriously, despite a chorus of protests. In the three synoptic Gospels, moreover, Jesus himself acknowledges his claim to the title. And Pilate asked him, "Art thou the King of the Jews?" And he answering said unto him, "Thou sayest it." Mark chapter 15, verse 2. In the English translation, this reply may sound ambivalent. In the original Greek, however, its import is quite unequivocal. It can only be interpreted as thou hast spoken correctly. And thus the phrase is interpreted whenever it appears elsewhere in the Bible. The Gospels were composed during and after the revolt of AD 68 to 74, when Judaism had effectively ceased to exist as an organized social, political, and military force. What is more, the Gospels were composed for a Greco-Roman audience, for whom they had, of necessity, to be made acceptable. Rome had just fought a bitter and costly war against the Jews. In consequence, it was perfectly natural to cast the Jews in the role of villains. Jesus could not possibly be portrayed as a political figure, a figure in any way linked to the agitation which culminated in the war. Finally, the role of the Romans in Jesus' trial and execution had to be presented as sympathetically as possible. Thus Pilate is depicted in the Gospels as a decent, responsible, and tolerant man. According to the Gospels, Jesus is initially condemned by the Sanhedrin, the council of Jewish elders, who then bring him to Pilate and beseech the procurator to pronounce against him. Historically, this makes no sense at all. In the three synoptic Gospels, Jesus is arrested and condemned by the Sanhedrin on the night of the Passover. But by Judaic law, the Sanhedrin was forbidden to meet over the Passover. In the Gospels, Jesus' arrest and trial occur at night, before the Sanhedrin. By Judaic law, the Sanhedrin was forbidden to meet at night, in private houses, or anywhere outside the precincts of the temple. In the Gospels, the Sanhedrin is apparently unauthorized to pass a death sentence, and this ostensibly would be the reason for bringing Jesus to Pilate. However, the Sanhedrin was authorized to pass death sentences by stoning, if not by crucifixion. If the Sanhedrin had wished to dispose of Jesus, it could have sentenced him to death by stoning on its own authority. There would have been no need to bother Pilate at all. It is possible, of course, that not all Jews were entirely innocent. Even if the Roman administration feared a priest king with a claim to the throne, it could not embark overtly on acts of provocation, acts that might precipitate a full-scale rebellion. Certainly, it would have been more expedient for Rome if the priest-king were ostensibly betrayed by his own people. It is thus conceivable that the Romans employed certain Sadducees as, say, agents provocateurs. But even if this were the case, the inescapable fact remains that Jesus was the victim of a Roman administration, a Roman court, a Roman sentence, Roman soldiery, and a Roman execution, an execution which, in form, was reserved exclusively for enemies of Rome. It was not for crimes against Judaism that Jesus was crucified, but for crimes against the empire. Is there any evidence in the Gospels that Jesus actually did have children? There is nothing explicit, but if Jesus was a rabbi, it would have been most unusual for him to remain childless. Indeed, it would have been unusual for him to remain childless whether he was a rabbi or not. But there is evidence of a more concrete, more specific kind. It consists of the elusive Barabbas, or Jesus Barabbas, for it is by this name that he is identified in the Gospel of Matthew. Modern scholars are uncertain about the derivation and meaning of Barabbas. Jesus Barabbas may be a corruption of Jesus Barabbi. Barabbi was a title reserved for the highest and most esteemed rabbis, and was placed after the rabbi's given name. Jesus Barabbi might therefore refer to Jesus himself. Alternatively, Jesus Barabbas might originally have been Jesus Bar-Rabbi, Jesus, son of the rabbi. There is no record anywhere of Jesus' own father having been a rabbi, but if Jesus had a son named after himself, that son would indeed have been Jesus Bar-Rabbi. There is one other possibility as well. Jesus Barabbas may derive from Jesus Bar-Abba, and since Abba is father in Hebrew, Barabbas would then mean son of the father, a fairly pointless designation unless the father is in some way special. If the father were actually the heavenly father, then Barabbas might again refer to Jesus himself. On the other hand, if Jesus himself is the father, Barabbas would again refer to his son. Whatever the meaning and derivation of the name, The figure of Barabbas is extremely curious. In the first place, Barabbas's name, like the Magdalene's, seems to have been subjected to a deliberate and systematic blackening. Just as popular tradition depicts the Magdalene as a harlot, so it depicts Barabbas as a thief. But if Barabbas was any of the things his name suggests, he is hardly likely to have been a common thief. Strictly speaking, the Gospels themselves do not describe Barabbas as a thief. According to Mark and Luke, he's a political prisoner, a rebel charged with murder and insurrection. In the Gospel of Matthew, however, Barabbas is described as a notable prisoner. And in the fourth Gospel, Barabbas is said to be, in the Greek, elestai. John chapter 18, verse 40. This can be translated as either robber or bandit. In its historical context, however, it meant something quite different. Lestes was in fact the term habitually applied by the Romans to the zealots, the militant nationalist revolutionaries who had been fomenting social upheaval. Since Mark and Luke agree that Barabbas is guilty of insurrection, and since Matthew does not contradict this assertion, it is safe to conclude that Barabbas was a zealot. But this is not the only information available on Barabbas. According to Luke, he'd been involved in a recent disturbance or riot in the city. History makes no mention of any such turmoil in Jerusalem at the time. The Gospels, however, do. According to the Gospels, there had been a civic disturbance in Jerusalem only a few days before, when Jesus and his followers overturned the tables of the moneylenders at the temple. Was this the disturbance in which Barabbas was involved and for which he was imprisoned? In that case, there is one obvious conclusion, that Barabbas was one of Jesus' entourage. According to modern scholars, the custom of releasing a prisoner on the Passover did not exist. But even if it did, the choice of Barabbas over Jesus would make no sense. If Barabbas were indeed a common criminal, guilty of murder, why would the people choose to have his life spared? And if he were indeed a zealot or a revolutionary, it's hardly likely that Pilate would have released so potentially dangerous a character rather than a harmless visionary. Of all the discrepancies, inconsistencies, and improbabilities in the Gospels, the choice of Barabbas is among the most striking and most inexplicable. One modern writer has proposed an intriguing and plausible explanation. He suggests that Barabbas was the son of Jesus, and Jesus a legitimate king. If this were the case, the choice of Barabbas would make sense. One must imagine an oppressed populace confronted with the imminent extermination of their spiritual and political ruler, the Messiah, whose advent had formerly promised so much. In such circumstances, would not the preservation of the bloodline be paramount, taking precedence over everything else? Would not a people faced with the dreadful choice prefer to see their king sacrificed in order that his offspring and his line might survive? If the line survived, there would at least be hope for the future. It's certainly not impossible that Barabbas was Jesus' son. Jesus is generally believed to have been born around 6 BC. The crucifixion occurred no later than AD 36, which would make Jesus at most 42 years of age. But even if he was only 33 when he died, he might still have fathered a son. In accordance with the customs of the time, he might have been married as early as 16 or 17. Yet, even if he didn't marry until age 20, he might still have a son, age 13, who by Judaic custom would have been considered a man. And of course, there may well have been other children too. Such children could have been conceived at any point up to within a day or so of the crucifixion. Jesus could well have sired a number of children prior to the crucifixion. If he survived the crucifixion, however, the likelihood of offspring would be still further increased. Is there any evidence that Jesus did indeed survive the crucifixion? Given the portrait of him in the Gospels, it is inexplicable that Jesus was crucified at all. According to the Gospels, Jesus had no particular quarrel with Rome and did not violate Roman law. And yet he was punished by the Romans, in accordance with Roman law and Roman procedures. And he was punished by crucifixion, a penalty exclusively reserved for those guilty of crimes against the empire. If Jesus was crucified, he cannot have been as apolitical as the Gospels depict him. On the contrary, he must have done something to provoke Roman wrath. Whatever the trespasses for which Jesus was crucified, His death on the cross is fraught with inconsistencies. There is, quite simply, no reason why his crucifixion, as the Gospels depict it, should have been fatal. The contention that it was warrants closer scrutiny. The Roman practice of crucifixion adhered to very precise procedures. After sentence, a victim would be flogged, and consequently weakened by loss of blood. His outstretched arms would then be fastened, usually by thongs, but sometimes by nails, to a heavy wooden beam, placed horizontally across his neck and shoulders. Bearing this beam, he would then be led to the place of execution. Here, with the victim hanging from it, the beam would be raised and attached to a vertical post or stake. Hanging thus from his hands, it would be impossible for the victim to breathe, unless his feet were also fixed to the cross, thus enabling him to press down on them and relieve the pressure on his chest. But despite the agony, a man suspended with his feet fixed, and especially a fit and healthy man, would usually survive for at least a day or two. Indeed, the victim would often take as much as a week to die. The agony could be terminated more quickly by breaking the victim's legs or knees, which in the Gospels, Jesus' executioners are about to do before they're forestalled. Breaking of the legs or knees was not an additional sadistic torment. On the contrary, it was an act of mercy, which caused a very rapid death. With nothing to support him, the pressure on the victim's chest would become intolerable, and he would quickly asphyxiate. There is consensus among modern scholars that only the fourth gospel rests on an eyewitness account of the crucifixion. According to the fourth gospel, Jesus' feet were affixed to the cross, thus relieving the pressure on his chest muscles, and his legs were not broken. He should therefore, in theory at least, have survived for a good 2 or 3 days. And yet, he is on the cross for no more than a few hours before being pronounced dead. Even Pilate is astonished by the rapidity with which death occurs. Mark, chapter 15, verse 44. What can have constituted the cause of death? Not the spear in his side, for the fourth gospel maintains that Jesus was already dead when this wound was inflicted on him. John chapter 19, verse 33. There is only one explanation. A combination of exhaustion, fatigue, general debilitation, and the trauma of the scourging. But not even these factors should have proved fatal so soon. In the Gospels, Jesus' death occurs at a moment that is almost too convenient. It occurs just in time to prevent his executioners breaking his legs, and by doing so, it permits him to fulfill an Old Testament prophecy. Modern authorities agree that Jesus modeled his life in accordance with such prophecies, which heralded the coming of a Messiah. It was for this reason that an ass had to be procured from Bethany on which he could make his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And the details of the crucifixion seem likewise engineered to enact the prophecies of the Old Testament. Jesus's apparent and opportune demise, which in the nick of time saves him from certain death and enables him to fulfill a prophecy, is, to say the least, suspect. It must either be a later interpolation after the fact or part of a carefully contrived plan. There is much additional evidence to suggest the latter. In the fourth gospel, Jesus, hanging on the cross, declares that he thirsts. In reply to this complaint, he is proffered a sponge allegedly soaked in vinegar, an incident that also occurs in the other Gospels. This sponge is generally interpreted as another act of sadistic derision. But was it really? Vinegar, or soured wine, is a temporary stimulant, with effects not unlike smelling salts. It was often used at the time to resuscitate flagging slaves on galleys. For a wounded and exhausted man, a sniff or taste of vinegar would induce a restorative effect, a momentary surge of energy. And yet in Jesus' case, the effect is just the contrary. No sooner does he inhale or taste the sponge than he pronounces his final words. Such a reaction to vinegar is physiologically inexplicable. On the other hand, such a reaction would be perfectly compatible with a sponge soaked not in vinegar, but in some type of soporific drug, a compound of opium and or belladonna, for instance, commonly employed in the Middle East at the time. But why proffer a soporific drug, unless the act of doing so along with all the other components of the crucifixion, were elements of a complex and ingenious stratagem. A stratagem designed to produce a semblance of death when the victim was still alive. Such a stratagem would not only have saved Jesus' life, but also